Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Heritage Matters, a programme brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust and kindly sponsored by Ryman Healthcare. I'm Dougal Stevenson. Like most of you, we're on holiday, so we thought it would be a good idea to repeat some of the best programmes we ran this year. And this week we start with a story by Bill Southworth about a Chinese miner called Ah Li, who was hanged at Dunedin Prison in the 19th century for a murder he may not have committed. Jane Edwards looks at the history of the now sadly closed Cadbury's factory, and Gregor Campbell covers the career of a notorious criminal called Robert Butler, who was charged with murdering a family of three in Cumberland Street. Doubts are raised about some modern murder convictions, and one which happened in 1880 would certainly have joined the list if it occurred today. Bill Southworth has been researching this murder, which provoked an anti-Chinese outburst and possibly caused the execution of an innocent man.
In August 1880, 58-year-old widow Mary Young was battered to death in her home at Kyburn. She was believed to be wealthy and was rumoured to have withdrawn money from the bank the day before. As she lay dying, she was questioned as to who had done it. Although it's unlikely Mrs. Young was thoroughly conscious at the time, she told one questioner that it had been bad men, and another that it had been Chinamen. Five local Chinese were arrested and offered a pardon and a reward if they would finger the murderer. One, 24-year-old Ah Li, eventually confessed to being at the murder scene with the murderer, a gold miner called Li Gai, who'd been a friend of Mrs. Young. They were not fluent in English, and a translator had to be used. The way the confession had been gathered was so dubious that the judge excluded it at their trial. However, the local newspaper, the Mount Ida Chronicle, was in no doubt as to who had done it.
In addition to the dying words of the murdered woman, we have certain evidence that confirms our belief that the perpetrators were Chinamen. The manner of the murder is not European. Their ordinary manner of murder is not the same. The sudden dispatch with a knife, stick, or pistol is their style. Everything points to the perpetrators being Chinese. We know the morals and principles of this race are very different from ours, and it's only for fear of consequences that many of our laws are respected by them. Ever since the Chinese came to the colonies, they have been credited with the committal of innumerable small sins, but fear has restrained them from great offences.
Whoever was going to be arrested, the Chronicle insisted that it be a Chinese, and went on to attack members of that race.
When a capital crime is committed by a European, every respectable member of the community does what he can to assist in capturing and punishing the criminal. But the Chinese in this community do exactly the reverse. Every possible obstacle is thrown in the way of the police.
The confession Ah Li had made may well have been in response to a £100 reward and a pardon offered to anyone who made a confession implicating someone else. Ah Li, in a statement, had said he was only peripherally involved and that the actual killer was Chinese miner Li Gai. Although Ah Li had withdrawn this confession, it was published in the newspapers, and so any jury would have been well aware of it. Feelings against the Chinese were running high when the case went to trial in Dunedin. The only real evidence seemed to be two handkerchiefs left at the murder scene, but there was a conflict of evidence. A local shopkeeper said he had sold similar handkerchiefs to Ah Li, but Ah Li insisted the ones found were not his. Another key piece of evidence was blood found on the knees of Ah Li's trousers. Ah Li said he had recently slaughtered a sheep and that it was sheep's blood. On this, his defence lawyer said,
"It appeared it was impossible to distinguish sheep's blood from human blood with accuracy, and it had only lately become possible for scientific men with a microscope much more powerful than the one used, plus other tests, to distinguish one from the other. There was no proof that Ah Li had not killed a sheep in the slaughter yard, as he had said. and his statement regarding that had not been followed up in the way it should and easily might have been.
Another troubling aspect of the trial was that much of the evidence was not translated into Chinese for the accused men. But there was worse yet. A hay fork from a farm some 250 metres away had been found outside the door to Mrs. Young's house. The hay fork belonged to a farmer friend of hers, Andrew Marshall. There was no explanation as to how it had got there. Marshall was subsequently committed to a mental asylum, where he confessed to the murder. His confession was put down to his mental illness. At the end of the trial, the jury found Ali guilty of murder, and he was sentenced to death by hanging. The other miner, Lee Guy, was acquitted and discharged. When Lee Guy returned to Naseby, he was set upon by a mob and had dirt and stones thrown at him. The Chronicle commented,
"It is hoped he has the sense to leave the district."
He didn't, and was still living in Kyburn in the early 1900s. The Anglican Bishop of Dunedin, Bishop Neville, who believed that a review of the evidence was in order, took up Ali's case. This led to a delay in the death sentence being carried out. It made the Mount Ida Chronicle almost apoplectic.
"The intelligence has reached here during the week that Bishop Neville had been endeavouring to come between the law and the convicted murderer, Ali. It was received in the first instance with surprise, and afterwards, when the facts were fully known, with indignation. Few people could believe that Bishop Neville was possessed of any latent acuteness by the active exercise of which he would be likely to discover anything in connection with the murder which had escaped the solemn tribunal under which the murderer was tried. We think it can easily be shown that Bishop Neville, in thus meddling with matters which he does not understand, is doing an act of cruelty to the prisoner and inflicting a grievous wrong upon the whole community."
Dunedin's Attorney General, Robert Stout, wrote openly to the press, accusing Neville of being brutally stupid. The bishop's intervention didn't work, and Ali was hanged at Dunedin Prison on a Friday morning in November 1880. Throughout his time in prison, he had insisted he was innocent. Asked to confess on the gallows, the 24-year-old said, "Me no killy Missy Young." At this distance, it's almost impossible to have an opinion as to Ali's guilt or innocence. But with modern forensics and DNA testing, who knows, there may have been a different result. The problem with capital punishment was that once the gallows trapdoor snapped open, it was too late to have second thoughts. This is Bill Southworth reporting.
The closure of Cadbury's factory. Jane Edwards traces the story of the company's founder, its phenomenal growth, and its demise in this part of the world.
As a young man, Richard Hudson worked in a railway workshop and in the baking trade, two areas of expertise which he developed to remarkable success in his business in Dunedin, adapting and designing much of the machinery used in his factories in the early days. He also had a stint on goldfields in Marlborough and the West Coast before coming to Dunedin in 1868, where he opened a bakery in Princess Street with a retail outlet in the arcade now Broadway. He's also reported to have sold biscuits from a barrow on the increasingly busy Dunedin wharves. He had acquired a biscuit-making oven, discarded after the New Zealand exhibition in Dunedin in 1865, and boasted in the Evening Star in 1869 of machine-made biscuits, superior in quality and lower in price than any other house. A reporter from the Evening Star visited the factory in 1870 and wrote,
"Very possibly, very few of our readers have any idea of the process by which those nice water biscuits, wine biscuits and sponge cakes for which Mr. Hudson has so large a sale are made. Dough making, we suppose, every lady understands. But they would scarcely believe how much more easily the hard work of kneading can be got over with the help of an hydraulic engine and a few pairs of rollers. All that hard work that used to make them look so rosy before it was finished is saved."
The reporter was also amazed to observe another contrivance adapted for shortening a common household operation.
"By a simple process, 100 eggs can be beat up in a quarter the time the cook requires to prepare hers for use."
A year or so later, Mr. Hudson purchased machinery for making confectionery, as well as the baked goods, and moved his factory to larger premises in Darling Street. Here he produced barley sugar, rose rock, almond toffee, acid drops, and other confections for a shilling a pound, along with biscuits and cakes, like our celebrated water biscuits, which were sold for sixpence a pound. By 1872, sponge cakes were larger than ever, selling for 1 shilling a dozen. According to an advertisement in the Evening Star,
"The sale of these cakes has reached the enormous quantity of 2,000 per week. We would remind the public that previous to our commencing the retail trade, the price of sponge cakes was 4 shillings a dozen."
With the business flourishing, Mr. Hudson expanded his premises yet again in 1875, converting the old Masonic Hall in Murray Place to a factory, later demolishing it and putting up a completely new building. Further development came when Richard Hudson visited Europe in 1884 and purchased the machinery needed to make cocoa and chocolate. It wasn't long before the manufacturer issued a challenge to the world in the advertising columns of the Otago Daily Times in August 1886.
"The public of Dunedin to be the judge. Hudson & Co.'s chocolate goods are the best in the market. Their chocolate almonds, noisettes, creams, nougats, drops, etc. cannot be equalled. To allow everyone to form their own opinion, we have arranged that for a fortnight only, sample boxes of each sort will be sold at sixpence each."
As the business expanded, so did the need for more staff. An advertisement in the Evening Star in November 1889 tells us R. Hudson and Company was looking for
"well-conducted girls, practiced packers preferred."
By 1894, there were 100 hands working in the factory, some of whom were proved and experienced workmen brought from Europe. By 1900, the staff had increased to 150, and the move had begun to the current site, bounded by Cumberland, St. Andrews, and Castle Streets, as Mr. Hudson bought out various businesses and acquired the land. Branches with warehouses had also been established in the other main centres. In 1903, Richard Hudson died at the age of 61 at his home, one of the grand mansions in Royal Terrace, and now the Buddhist Centre. But with his 6 sons joining the company, it went on to flourish and expand further in size and output. The next major milestone occurred in 1930, brought about by the competition from imported chocolates. Tariffs protected Hudson's for a time, but the eventual outcome was a merger with Cadbury Fry, as the English company had become. This brought together two companies not only producing comparable products, but also with a similar ethos regarding the welfare of staff. Cadbury's famously built an entire village on the outskirts of Birmingham in England to provide decent housing for its staff, who had been living in slum-like conditions in the city. They called it Bourneville, the name also given to its cocoa. In Dunedin, Richard Hudson was similarly known for his concern for staff working conditions. He was a strong advocate of an 8-hour working day and is reported to have been the first manufacturer in Dunedin to discontinue work on Saturday afternoons. In the 1930s, Buzz Bars and Santy Bars made their appearance. 1939 saw the beginning of Sir Carl Smith's 24-year tenure as managing director, and the start of the Second World War, when most of the output from the Dunedin factory was devoted to war contracts. With sugar in short supply, Cadbury Fry Hudson cancelled most of its confectionery lines to concentrate on chocolate blocks, 5 million tins of which were sent as emergency rations to New Zealand and Allied forces. Cadbury's itself had 250 staff members serving in the armed forces. On the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Monte Cassino, Cadbury's received a letter from a former signalman with the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, who, during the battle, had been instructed to make telephone contact with those occupying the ruins of the historic abbey. He writes,
"As they'd been isolated for some time, I decided to fill my battle dress jacket with energy chocolate tablets to help them until food supplies could be got through. I assure you that the chocolate was well received when we finally reached them and enabled them to hold out until they were relieved.
In the years of growth that followed, the premises were expanded, new plant was installed, and new products like Pinky Bars, Crunchy Bars, Morrow Bars and Flake were launched. Dog pemmican was made for Sir Edmund Hillary's dogs for his 1956 Antarctic expedition, and the factory started making Girl Guide biscuits. Carl Smith was succeeded as managing director by Ted Barringer, Colin Wise and Frank Miller before one of the founder's great-great-grandsons, Paul Hudson, took over. His departure in 1996 severed the family's connections with the company. In any event, the name Hudson had gone a few years earlier when its biscuit manufacturing was transferred to Griffin's and the Dunedin factory concentrated on making chocolate under the name Cadbury Confectionery Limited. Cadbury's was taken over by Kraft Foods in 2010, and 2 years later, the confectionery business became Mondelez International, whose billion-dollar cost-cutting program has seen the demise of the Cadbury factory in Dunedin. Sources for this story included the book Sweet Success by former managing director Ted Barringer and Papers Past, extracts from which were read by Dougal Stevenson. This is Jane Edwards reporting for Heritage Matters.
In March 1880, Dunedin citizens woke to the dreadful news that a family of three had died in a house fire in Cumberland Street. Worse was to follow. An habitual criminal called Robert Butler was charged with their murders. His trial then proved to be most unusual. This report from Gregor Campbell.
There's a certain kind of person who finds cemetery inscriptions interesting. There's a certain kind of person who, when he reads the words brutally murdered as part of an inscription, has to know why those words are on the stone. I am that certain kind of person. The Dewar's grave in Dunedin's Southern Cemetery bears those words. The Dewar family, James, Elizabeth, and nine-month-old Elizabeth, died in what came to be known as the Cumberland Street Tragedy. They died by the hand of one Robert Butler, who got away with murder. The Evening Star of March 15, 1880, pulled no punches.
Since the atrocious deeds of the Burgess and Kelly gang, nothing has occurred in this colony so full of horror as the murder yesterday morning of the unfortunate Grant family. The whole circumstances, so far as at present known, point to predetermined action, and the cold-blooded monster who perpetrated the crime appears carefully to have chosen his time and opportunity, and to have used a weapon which effectually made sure of his victims. He killed them, and this is a matter worth noting, which possibly has not escaped the attention of the police, much after the fashion in which a bullock is dispatched in the slaughter yard. The presumption is that the man who could deal such death blows with nerve and precision had had his hand in similar work before.
Robert Butler, this was the most famous of a number of names he used, was born on the mean streets of Melbourne. He grew up mean himself and did his first prison time at the age of 12 for vagrancy. Two more stretches and a few years later he was 16, armed with a pistol and sticking people up. He spent five more years behind bars. By the year 1876, Butler might have found himself too well known by his local police and he left for New Zealand. Again, he had read voraciously in prison, particularly the lives of great men, men for whom the usual rules of decent society did not apply. He clearly saw himself in the mould of someone outside the rules, someone for whom other humans were of value only as far as they were of use to him. On reaching Dunedin, he set off for the goldfields, not to dig, but to take up the position of teacher at Cromwell's Catholic School. On the western side of the Dunstan Range near Bendigo, Butler, then calling himself Donnelly, stopped for a rest at the Rise and Shine gold mine and was proudly shown the results of a week's work. One of the four miners also offered him a bed for the night, which he readily accepted. but Butler had plans which did not include much in the way of sleep. James Rattray, writing to the Otago Daily Times in 1928, recounted the story he had been told.
Butler's subsequent career of murder and criminality showed how unflinchingly capable he was of wiping out the miner's family and home when the tragic moment of doom should seal their fate. The moments fraught with destiny passed unsuspected in the bosom of the miner's family and cottage. The sands of the hourglass gave no inkling of the secret held in their sinking, save to one. The family, as was their customary habit, each engaged in prayer, and all included the stranger within the gate in their supplications, commending the keeping of their souls to God. Upon a scene so hallowed, the mantle of sleep fell silently, softer than the beating wings of the angel of death. In the morning, the miner put Butler on the road for Cromwell, not before the pair had had a serious conversation on spiritual matters, conversation carried over from the night before. Anxious that Butler should commence his 16-mile walk to Cromwell dry-shod, the miner carried his departing guest over a fast-running mountain stream on his back. Before turning to go his way, Butler made the full and frank confession that he had entered the miner's home on the previous evening with murder in his heart, determined at that cost to possess himself of the stock of gold he had been shown so unsuspectingly. Coveting the gold, he had schemed and decided on wholesale murder that night. He further confessed that through the sincere personal efforts put forth for his good, and through the simple confidence and earnestness of the family devotions, he had been deterred from his awful purpose. The miner paid no particular attention at the time to Butler's strange voluntary confession. After events proved, however, that Butler was fully capable of carrying out the dark designs of murder and robbery. At the close of that very day, he had robbed a church of its communion silver plate, and very shortly afterwards was standing his trial in connection with the murder of a family in Cumberland Street.
Butler did well in Cromwell, teaching in the Catholic school and also establishing a profitable night school as well. His past was unknown and his education and charm would have stood out in the mining town. But he soon slipped into his old ways and he burgled the house of his employer, Father Kehoe, stealing the large sum of £50. When the crime was discovered, Butler was successful in passing suspicion onto one of his pupils, but Butler's coincidental extravagance in clothes and jewellery put the authorities on the right track. Butler fled to Dunedin. In Dunedin, Butler continued the trade of burglary and was given 4 years penal servitude. On release, he made good his claim reported at his later trial that he would become the most desperate tiger that ever was let loose upon the community. He burgled a doctor's house, setting it alight to erase the evidence. Then he did the same to the Dewar's residence, but before lighting the candle placed under the marriage bed, he killed them both with an axe to the head. Their daughter, Elizabeth, died from the smoke. Dunedin police were sure of their man when Butler was charged with murder and burglary. He defended himself with a 5.5-hour speech to the jury and was acquitted of murder. Part of his defence, explaining his abrupt departure from Dunedin and observed nervous disposition while travelling north, was that he had committed the previous night's burglary and arson, and that was the only reason for his subsequent activity. Two things in his legal position were in his favour. As his own legal representative, he could not be cross-examined by the prosecution, nor could the prosecution rebut his speech. And Victorian-era juries were loath to convict on a capital charge unless they were certain of guilt. Butler was given 18 years for burglary, the judge noting that he had been found not guilty of murder, but not found innocent of it. While in prison, Butler made a strange confession to another notorious criminal, Garrett, the bushranger, who wrote a column titled Prison Portraits. The content of Butler's portrait can be discerned from a letter written in response by someone signing himself Policeman X.
To the editor of The Globe, Sir,
Under the above heading, I see Christchurch Society professes to give the career of the convict Robert Butler, who was supposed to have committed the Cumberland Street murders in Dunedin about 2 years ago. The correctness, or otherwise, of his history is a matter of small importance, but the article contains a slanderous attack, as false as it is gratuitous, on the fame of Mrs. Dewar, who was one of the victims of that outrage. She is represented as having received a quantity of jewellery from Butler in Melbourne, and having refused to return it to him in Dunedin, although admitting that she had it. The writer of the article knew Butler in the Dunedin jail, and adds, "Butler says he could have borne the loss of the lady, but not of the loot," and then proceeds to say, on Butler's authority, that to become repossessed of the jewellery was the object of the murder. This is a pure fabrication, and no doubt, if society was aware of the responsibility it incurred by publishing such a libel, prison portraits would not have appeared. Mrs. Dewar was well known in Dunedin. Her character was unimpeachable, and there was no reason to believe that she had ever seen Butler. It is childish to suppose that Butler made the statements to which the author of Prison Portraits has imputed to him. For were he to make any such confession, he would quickly change his place in the Littleton jail for the dock and the scaffold. I am yours, etc.
Dunedin and the rest of the world had to wait 25 years to see justice for the Dewar family's murder. Back in Australia, and back at his old career of burglary and armed stick-up man, he shot a victim during a struggle. The Butler of 1905 had not the presence of 1880. He was found guilty of murder and hanged. The hanging was not done well and was a messy affair. Some might say it was what he deserved. For more details of the ghastly career of Mr. Butler, a.k.a. Donnelly, a.k.a. etc., etc., you can find them on my blog at otagotaffofile, all one word, .blogspot.co.nz, or search for In Loving Memory at Blogspot.
In that item from Gregor Campbell, you also heard the voices of Mark Champion, yours truly, and Bill Southworth. Ryman Healthcare prides itself on offering some of the most resident-friendly terms in New Zealand. Ryman Healthcare's Francis Hodgkins and Yvette Williams retirement villages in Dunedin offer the very best of retirement living and care. For more information and to discuss your retirement living options, please phone Kate on 455-7936. Ryman Healthcare. Supporting Southern Heritage Trust and the Heritage Matters Program.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.